We're now ready to move on to the second case on our calendar today. Lawyers should feel free to settle in at the tables. While you're doing that, I will ask the marshal to call the second case so that our record is clear. All right, and again, take your time, counsel, as you settle into the table. I'll just make a few quick remarks, and some of them are probably very familiar to you since I'm sure you've been here before. We do have a total of five cases on the calendar today. Three of those are argued orally. This is the second case. We ask you to make note of the audio recording that we are making today. That audio recording will be made available later on the court's website. Because we do make an audio recording, we ask you to do one thing. As you start your argument, identify yourself for the record, as well as the client you represent. Please keep your eye on the clock. The clock telling you how much time you have remaining is easiest to see if you stand in the center podium. You do have the option, though, of choosing either the side podiums. They are mic'd. The center podium, though, does go up and down, and like I said, it makes it easier for you to follow the clock. So with that, I think that we are ready, counsel for appellant, but if you need a few more moments, we understand, but when you are ready, go right ahead.
And I am ready. Shall I? Good morning. May it please the court, Ms. Peralta. My name is Barry Edwards. I'm with the Keller Law Offices, and I'm here this morning on behalf of Daniel Seralta. The court may know there's a now semi-retired judge, federal judge out of New York, named Jed Rakoff, who published an important piece in the New York Review of Books, I'm going to say 7 or 8 years ago. I didn't look at the date. And in it, he says, among other things, the criminal justice system in the United States today bears little relationship to what the founding fathers contemplated, what the movies and television portray, or what the average American believes. I submit that today's case, the Saldana case, is an extreme example of what Judge Rakoff was talking about. The victim in this case, and I'm uncomfortable given my day job using the word victim, but Mr. Saldana has been convicted, so legally she's the victim, testified for about 19 minutes. And much of that testimony, as is perfectly appropriate, with a young child, I think she was 9 or 10 at the time, was stuff about her hobbies, her interests. Very little of it was about the allegations. And all of her testimony, live testimony, about the allegations is contained in my brief, and it's about half a page. It's maybe 8-10 lines. Other than that, it was a 3-day trial. Other than that, there were three people called by the prosecution whom we dispute whether they should be considered as experts, and that'll be part of what we talk about today. And to get back to Judge Rakoff's observation, what he's referring to, among other things, again, is that used to be what was admitted in court, what was admitted in a criminal, and I don't mean this court, I mean a trial court, what was admitted in a criminal trial was allegations made by an accuser. And the Confrontation Clause, and we're talking about the federal constitution in the case of Judge Rakoff's objection, the Confrontation Clause of the Sixth Amendment allows cross-examination. The truth of what the person has to say is tested in the crucible of cross-examination, as we say. But in this case, as is increasingly so often the case, there was a video. And there were multiple people who testified as to the reliability of the statement in the video, but it was uncross-examinable. I don't know if that's hyphenated or one word or what, but...
Trial counsel did have an opportunity to cross-examine the victim at trial, right?
And I anticipated that question, and, of course, and you're right, but... Excuse me, I'm just going to grab a Kleenex. But because the direct exam was so brief and so limited, defense counsel, would have been forced to say something like, well, in the video we're going to see tomorrow, you say this thing, and let me ask you about that. I mean, that's not effective cross-examination. Furthermore... So,
counsel, you've referred to some changes in the criminal justice system over time, but there is something that hasn't changed in appellate advocacy or appellate review. It does fall to appellant's counsel to preserve the errors that they are raising to the appellate court. And that the point that you just made, that you foreclosed, you or trial counsel foreclosed asking questions because of the scope of direct examination, that was never raised, was it, in district court proceedings? I couldn't find it, and I've looked. So I don't see where you preserve the challenge you're bringing today.
No, I can't think. I'm trying to think through both the transcript of objections at the time plus the motions in limine, some of which were sort of ongoing throughout the trial. But counsel... For the state.
So your answer is no, right, counsel? You didn't preserve that issue. The quote-unquote limited scope of direct examination, the limited scope of direct examination foreclosed your cross. I just don't see where it's presented to the district court in any way.
I think you're right.
Okay, thank you.
However, because, you know, I'm a lawyer, it depends.
Pardon me?
I said, because I'm a lawyer, I'm going to end everything with it depends. I would still say that while the state says in her brief 24 times that an argument is forfeited or some variation of the verb to forfeit, we're still here today because things that are forfeited, and it's too bad that trial counsel, it wasn't me, didn't object to that particular issue. But these aren't jurisdictional issues. There's still plain error review.
Did your brief raise plain error? That was the brief that you filed and wrote, right? I mean, the
yes.
one we're talking about today.
Yes.
I didn't see plain error raised in your brief. And that's pointed out in respondents.
And,
I didn't see any response to that. And no reply brief was submitted to articulate where you did argue for plain error review.
My recollection of my brief is that I argued plain error except on the subject of the admissibility of an evidentiary ruling. I think it was maybe it was the expert admission of the expert of the experts, but I thought I raised, and if I didn't, I should have.
You know, I'm not trying to put you on the spot unnecessarily. So your brief speaks for itself, obviously, and to the extent you would like to address this during your rebuttal time, that's very appropriate. It would help me, though, in my review of your case, if you point out where you raised plain error review and how you articulated those elements, because you do raise a number of evidentiary concerns that are obviously very important to your client. But as I said, there are some things about appellate review that haven't changed. And one of them is preservation error in the district court. The second one is that it falls to the appellant to articulate the issues and the legal theories on which it is asking the appellate court to review the case that appellant is presenting. So if you didn't argue plain error review, that puts this court in a spot, doesn't it? So as
yes,
I said,
Your Honor,
you don't need to pursue that further now. I don't want to cut off your argument. You go right ahead and argue it as you'd like. I just would like you to know I didn't see that and I'm looking for it. So if you could address it in rebuttal, that would be helpful to me.
I will. Thank you.
Could I follow up with one question? The person who conducted the forensic interview on the video recording was a state's witness as well, correct?
Yes.
Okay, just confirming.
Ms. Johnson. Unfortunately, yeah, two of the experts had the same first name, which is kind of confusing.
And she was cross-examined, I take it?
She was, yes.
Okay.
And let's talk about her and the other two people, the other two state's witnesses who were not family members. There were three people. I say they were experts. Respondent says that two of them were fact witnesses. And we may have to make new law. We can't do that here, but maybe if I petition for review later, in the off chance that I lose here today, there's experts and there's experts. What we had was three people. All three spent most of their time in the witness chair touting their credentials, saying, I've studied corner house protocol. I think they're all three corner house. I've studied corner house protocol, and the corner house protocol is a very reliable way, they insist, of getting accurate statements of the truth. And we got two issues here. Well, three. One is, once they start saying that, they're no longer fact witnesses. They're testifying about their opinion about what they maintain is a scientific procedure for ascertaining the truth. And as I said, we have this unassailable video that then plays that these three witnesses have told the jury has special truth sauce sprinkled on it. One of them, Ms. Johnson, who we agree was qualified as an expert, it was actually expressly qualified as an expert at trial.
So which Johnson are you saying you've agreed is expressly qualified?
I believe there's one, there's Rachel Johnson.
Right, that's who I thought you meant, but I wanted to make sure I understood. So Rachel Johnson, you are not raising her qualifications on appeal.
Oh, I question her qualifications, absolutely. I think under Rule 702, and that's a big part of my brief.
Okay, well, that's what I thought, but I misunderstood. I thought you said in district court you did not challenge Rachel Johnson's qualifications. Did I misunderstand you?
I can't tell you if trial counsel...
And again, I'm saying you, and I recognize it's trial counsel, but... So.
Mr. Saldana,
yeah.
Just to be clearer. I don't think trial counsel did raise that issue, but again, I'll look at that for my rebuttal. But let's talk about Ms. Johnson.
Well, before I just want to make sure I'm clear, too, because there's a couple of different ways of looking at it. It seemed like you were saying that, in actuality, there are three expert witnesses, even though there was only one that the district court admitted under the expert witness rule.
Correct.
So, and as to that one, you are challenging that ruling. And
yes.
the qualifications. As to the other two, are you saying that we need to, as a court of appeals, apply 702, the expert witness rule, to witnesses who were not admitted as experts, and that they didn't meet that rule?
Well, there's multiple ways of.
I'm just asking what you're saying to us about those two, because I think that helps clarify a little bit of how we address. Right, on the one that there may have been an objection to qualifications as an expert, we can address that issue. But to the ones that were not admitted as experts, it seems odd that we would apply Rule 702 in the first instance to those witnesses and then conclude either under a plain error or some other base, then try to conclude that they weren't qualified when their qualifications were never challenged, right? And then the state didn't have an opportunity to voir dire the witnesses to establish qualifications because that wasn't how those witnesses, aren't we limited to the mechanism through which that testimony was admitted and not looking at that testimony through a Rule 702?
Well, I also raised the issue of insufficient evidence.
Okay, but before you move on to that topic, I'm asking you to tell us, is that correct, that your argument is that the two fact witnesses were actually expert witnesses, and we are applying 702 to that testimony.
And the reason I went to the insufficient evidence or strike their testimony as improper. Let's hypothetically say that it was not improper expert testimony, but hearsay that shouldn't have been admitted. I believe this court would then, well, if there was an objection, review it as abuse of discretion. If there wasn't an objection, I suppose we're under the modified plain error standard. But if someone had testified materially as to hearsay, then this court could address that. And we got a hypothetical with multiple possibilities here, but let's say it was objected to.
Let me put it this way. Is there any authority in your brief that allows us to apply Rule 702 to the admission of evidence that wasn't admitted under that rule?
Something else I'm going to have to look for, but I argue Rule 702 and that it wasn't admissible. And so I think that this court, under admittedly the very high,
and what about the in a normal circumstance, there's an objection made to someone's qualifications, and an attorney says this is actually expert testimony, right? In a normal circumstance, the proponent of that testimony would then have a chance to voir dire. What do we do with the fact that that's not here? There is no opportunity for the state. Does that mean plain error is no longer available as a way? And it really is one of those circumstances where it's completely forfeited or waived because the state had no opportunity.
May I answer?
You may.
I did anticipate that question, and the judge at trial court isn't a helpless bystander, just sort of waiting for someone to object. When something happens that is improper in court, the judge, under both case law and the rules of judicial conduct, has the authority and even the responsibility to say, wait a minute, stop, that's improper. Everyone's primary focus should be the fundamental constitutional rights of Mr. Saldana, the defendant in this case. And when someone is testifying as an expert, when someone's giving opinion testimony, when someone's giving material opinion testimony in front of a jury, then the judge has every right, or if, to get back to Ms. Johnson, when she is unqualified, the judge, trial counsel doesn't object, the judge has the not only opportunity but responsibility to say, no, those aren't sufficient qualifications. My time is up. I will look for the answers to your questions.
Thank you, counsel. Counsel for a respondent, we're ready when you are ready.
Your Honors, Counsel, may it please the Court. My name is Lisa Lodeen Peralta. I'm an Assistant Attorney General, and I represent the state of Minnesota, who is the respondent in this case. The state did a very meticulous review of the record prior to submitting its brief in this case. Having to do so in a situation where it received an appellant's brief that had no references to the record in the statement of facts. And I will point out, as counsel mentioned sufficiency of the evidence in his oral argument, it is an impossible burden for an appellant to try to raise the sufficiency of the evidence argument when they have a statement of facts with no references to the record. So, the court is aware of the issues that the state has raised in regards to forfeiture and waiver, mostly forfeiture in this instance. So I need not belabor the issues, but I will point out, as Judge Bryan, you noted, the numerous issues raised by the appellant on appeal that were not raised down below in the district court makes it impossible for the state on appeal to respond. We had no chance at the district court to, for example, shore up the qualifications of our expert witness or respond to
But what does that mean? Let's bring it home, right? What does that mean for our review? Is it reviewable? Is there some other standard of review? It seems odd that we'd be looking at plain error when the state didn't have an opportunity to voir dire the witness because there was no objection. So what does the case law tell us is the appropriate standard of review in that sense?
Well, the court can decline to consider an issue. And that is what I have. If you get to Rule 31.02 and what the Pulczynski court said from the Supreme Court in 2022, this court does not have to take up an issue that's raised in a brief for the first time on appeal that was never raised before the district court. And this is a very appropriate time for you as the appellate court to look and say, it's just not fair for us to review this issue. It's not the defendant slash appellant has not done their job at the district court of raising the issue, giving the state an opportunity to litigate the issue, giving the district court judge an opportunity to use its discretion to rule on an evidentiary issue, to come up here to write a brief that includes citations to the record that can help point us to what their actual arguments are. It's not appropriate for almost all of the issues in here for this court to exercise discretion under Rule 31.02 to take review of the issues. Now, in direct response to your question, you asked if there had argued plain error below. Not once. There's no reference whatsoever.
Counsel, if I can just ask you quickly, you mean, are you talking about the appellant's brief or are you talking about district court? You're talking about appellant's brief?
Okay, yes.
Thank you.
Yes. So they laid out 3 pages of standard of review, Roman numeral 8 through Roman numeral 10. These do not include plain error. Not only, and we know sometimes
and the... So, counsel, you made a quick reference to the, and I'll probably say it wrong, the Pulczynski case, which you do have cited in your brief and in a couple of places, 20, 25, 45. But that's what you're referring to, is that you recommend the court take the approach that the Supreme Court took in that case and simply decline to review? And I'm just trying to understand your position.
Right.
Yeah,
so right. In Pulczynski, right, they note the 3 prongs of plain error doctrine. But then you add to that the 4th evaluation that the court has to do on whether the court should make the decision to take on the case. So you have the 3 prongs of plain error plus this 4th one of just a decision of whether the court should take on the case. And I'm saying, no, you don't have to do that, and you shouldn't do that. It's not fair to the state as a party. And as I noted in some of the forfeiture law, the defendant, the appellant, they have to play by the rules. They have to follow the rules in the district court in order to make their objections, to preserve them, to give the opposing party an opportunity to respond to them, to give the judge an opportunity to exercise their discretion. It is not incumbent upon us to make their argument for them at the appellate court for you to decide it sort of de novo. I mean, when did we hear prior to oral argument today that the 2 other witnesses, Pudenz and Liebel, should be stricken as improper testimony? I mean, that's brought up completely out of the air during oral argument today. How can I respond to that? And so that is the bulk of the arguments that I made in the brief that we have to rely on. So, you know,
Ms. Peralta, with respect to the qualifications of the expert witness, why can't we review the issue, but in a limited way, and recognizing that the question is whether the district court was obligated to insert itself sua sponte And why not, why couldn't we review while giving the state every benefit of the doubt or every benefit of the unknown, and simply, and then determine, based on all of those considerations, that there's no plain error?
Absolutely you can, Your Honor. I have been generalizing throughout much of this argument, and that is in part because the appellant claims there were three expert witnesses. I don't think there's any basis in law to make a conclusion that they were expert witnesses. When you narrow it down to the one person who was qualified as an expert witness, the district court qualified her as a witness. The defense counsel said he had no objections to her qualifications. Now, despite that, yes, you can take the issue up on plain error as to that one witness, not the other two who are never expert witnesses in the first place. You can choose to do so, absolutely. We win either way. She was clearly qualified. 17-page curriculum vitae, and no challenges. These types of witnesses with those types of backgrounds are admitted in child sex abuse cases all of the time. So absolutely, that issue you can take up. But again, there was an explicit statement by defense counsel that he did not object to her qualifications. When
you're talking about Rachel Johnson there,
yes.
Right?
Yeah. Okay. Yes. So appellant's counsel says the judge is not an innocent bystander here. Well, the judge is, you know, in charge of the courtroom, but the judge is not supposed to interfere with the presentation of evidence in the ordinary case. And
unless there's plain error, right? Isn't that essentially the implication of the plain error scope of appellate review, that in some situations the district court is obligated to insert itself? Limited situations, to be
very limited situations. But if the court wants to go into a plain error type of review, you have the whole prong. So it's not just, oh, you know, the judge should interfere with the presentation of evidence when there's a plain error. They would have to go beyond that in order to get somewhere before this court and use the whole plain error doctrine and establish to this court that they're entitled to relief, that there's a reversible error allowing new trial, which there's nothing in their brief suggesting that for any of the issues that they raise.
So, counsel, Judge Johnson, if you wanted to follow up on plain error, I'm happy to listen to that. I just want to make sure that we have an opportunity to hear about some of the other issues, because I feel, if I'm tracking your arguments, you're focused primarily on the challenge to the expert testimony, whether it's all three, one or more. But we have other other issues presented by the appellant, and there was an objection made to the admission of the recorded interview, both as being inadmissible hearsay as well as a violation of the Confrontation Clause. And there was reference to that during district court proceedings as well. So would you tell us why you disagree with the appellant's
sure.
argument?
Sure. Yeah. So first of all, we get back again to sort of the preservation of the issues. So very unusual set of circumstances, if you ask me. So the prosecution put forth a motion seeking to admit into evidence the forensic interview. They did this in document 42 on September 14th, 2021. This followed a notice of intent.
Counsel, I'm familiar with this. It's been pretty thoroughly briefed by the parties. But there was an objection made by trial counsel prior to the actual admission of the videotape recording. It was brief, but it was on both grounds, hearsay grounds, as well as confrontation clause.
Right.
And of course, we obviously got the briefing that we did from appellant's counsel on those two issues.
Okay.
So if you could move forward to that point and assume that what we have before us today is a challenge at a minimum that the district court abused its discretion in receiving this videotape recorded interview under the hearsay rules.
All right.
Okay.
So under statute 595.02, subdivision 3.
Which is not, those are not the hearsay rules. So that's what I'm, one of the issues I'm hoping you'll address is that the district court's analysis primarily went under the statute, which isn't the rules of evidence, it's the statute. Right. And how do you think this court should analyze that?
Okay. So the limited objection that defense counsel made at trial was this phrase, it's a hearsay document and confrontation. That is the extent of the objection. Okay. So nobody's disputing it's hearsay. The judge had already made a ruling that it was admissible, a preliminary ruling, that it was admissible hearsay under the statute 595.02. So the objection that it's hearsay is
The question that I'd hope you could help us out with is when you have I'll call it a statutory rule of evidence.
Okay.
Right? 63420 is another example where the legislator has seen fit to pass a law that governs admissibility of evidence. And you have the rules of evidence. Mm-hmm. How do those interact with each other? And I specifically, in this statute, it says, although it says the word otherwise, right? So maybe that's a key as to how this should be read in conjunction with our rules of evidence.
When the plaintiff makes a motion that is to admit hearsay pursuant to a statute, the defense can object that it's hearsay, but that objection is meaningless or moot because the statute would trump.
And what case law do you rely on for that, counsel?
I don't have that off the top of my head.
You know, I looked for that point in the briefs. And, you don't have a specific recollection. I won't take
Ms. Peralta,
too much
time. What about what I said about the use of the word otherwise? The statute says hearsay by a child under the age of 10, not otherwise admissible. Right? Is admissible under the statute.
Correct.
So what is that? How does that affect this discussion here?
Well, it takes away the hearsay objection as a valid objection because it doesn't matter for that admissibility whether it's hearsay or not, whether it's admissible or not under any of the hearsay rules or exclusions.
So essentially, the statute applies if the rules of evidence. You look at that and it say it's inadmissible.
Absolutely.
Inadmissible hearsay. The statute could still come into play.
Trumps it.
Okay.
Yes.
So, counsel, you did make, at least the state below, made the argument, actually, that this recorded interview was not hearsay. They argued that it was considered as a prior consistent statement of the witness, which under Rule 801 is defined to be not hearsay. Is that still the argument that you're making on appeal?
I would continue that argument. I guess my point was more that it was an out-of-court statement being admitted for the truth. So I do believe...
I'm not referring to that definition of hearsay at all.
Oh,
I'm talking about a prior consistent statement under Rule 801. And the district court does have some analysis of that.
Absolutely.
Quite a bit in writing in the pretrial order.
Correct.
But reserves a final ruling on the 801 issue as to whether it is or is not hearsay.
Right, and had to because the witness had not yet testified. I see my time is up. Do you want me to briefly
finish the answer.
Thank you. Correct. The judge had to wait upon ruling until the child witness testified, and based on the previous determinations under an evaluation of the rule and the child's testimony, did find it was a reasonably consistent, and allowed it under that rule as well. So the judge made dual decisions on admissibility, and the appellant has not successfully shown this court that was error.
So if I'm following your answer, just one more quick
sure.
point. You're saying that the district court did make a final ruling under Rule 801 for the admission of the recorded interview during the trial.
Absolutely.
Yeah. And I thought that was your position, but I wanted to make sure.
Yes.
Thank you. Anything else from the panel? Looks like not. Okay. So, counsel for appellant, we're ready to hear your rebuttal. You have 5 minutes if you choose.
Thank you, Your Honor. There were several things I was sent back to my desk to look up quickly on the role of the judge, and Judge Johnson addressed some of this. I'd point the court to, I'm going to butcher this name, Salitros. It's Salitros, 499 Northwest 2nd, 815. That's Supreme Court, 1993. And the relevant pages are between 815 and 817. But the Salitros court points out repeatedly that the trial judge, quote, has the responsibility for safeguarding both the rights of the accused and the interest of the public in the administration of justice. Skipping a citation, the adversary nature of the proceedings does not relieve the trial judge of the obligation of raising on his or her initiative at all appropriate times and in an appropriate manner matters which may significantly promote a determination of the trial. And then, without spending all my time reading these quotations, another case I'd point the court to is Schlogel, S-C-H-L-O-E-G-L, 915 Northwest 2nd, 14 at page 18, and that's from the Court of Appeals in 2018.
Okay, but those general principles aren't necessarily helpful to us. In this particular case, we have let's focus in on the expert testimony issue. And the fact that there was no objection on the grounds that the testimony being presented was expert testimony, not fact testimony, and then no objection following that, that this wasn't an expert. So is that the kind of error contemplated by that decision? There are times when a district court's supposed to step in, but there are times when it's error to step in and interfere with the defense. So those general principles don't really help us much unless there's a case you can point to that says this particular decision, right, not to step in when it's possible a witness is now getting into expert witness territory without an objection, that that's the time. Where's that case that says a district court commits error or that it affects the presentation of the case or whatever the language was in the general principle? Where's that case related to this issue?
I am confident there is not a case that says that there is not a case that says that when a witness starts giving opinion testimony, that specifically a judge should then step in and say, "Wait a minute, you're not qualified as an expert." But as Judge Johnson said a few minutes ago, it is plain error for a witness to give testimony outside of his or her, in this case, they're all her, his or her area of competence.
I'm not sure it is plain. It depends on the testimony, and it depends on the arguments of counsel. It might not be plain. It might not even be error. But the question I have is can we review it? If this had happened in trial, if there had been it's not a normal plain error review, because there's something that would have obligated the state to then do something that didn't happen here.
Rehabilitation sort of?
Voir dire the witness. The established qualifications of an expert witness. The state doesn't know it's supposed to do that if there's no objection made in the first place. So it's hard for us to even apply plain error.
But I think that's where Rule 702 and the cases I just cited come in, where the judge has, I mean, let's take the example from my brief. When a witness starts saying that based on my training and training experience is not the right state. Based on my education and experience, I can tell by phrenology and feeling the bumps on her head that she's telling the truth. And the jury's writing this down, does the judge step in and say, wait a minute, that's not foundationally reliable under Rule 702? I mean, at what point does the
argument.
Judge...
I was hoping there would be some case law that would guide our determination of, A, can we review it or not? And it doesn't seem like you're able to provide that as you stand here today, so I appreciate that. But I think that this particular issue of whether something is expert or not may not be the kind of thing contemplated in the case that you stated with that general principle.
I don't think there's a case that says specifically that applies to admission of expert testimony absent sufficient foundation. My time is up. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Our thanks to both lawyers in this case. We very much appreciate getting the opportunity to discuss the issues with you today in court. This matter is now submitted to the court for its decision. We will issue a written decision within the statutory time frame. Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.